it could be, because depends on what research you look at. Around 70% of communication is nonverbal, and we say a lot with our gestures, our nonverbal forms of communication. Yeah. Any questions on where we are up to this point? Thoughts that you've had? Okay, let's just jump right in and begin in verse 8. And you'll remember in this section he is talking more about to walk in purity. And he's going to begin talking about walking as children of light. And he says, for you were once darkness. What's he saying? You were once darkness.
Sinful.
Yeah, sinful. That's a good way of describing it. You were once sinful, but now you are light, or righteous. Okay? And the Bible often uses that, especially John in his writings. Darkness having to do with sin and error, where light has to do with truth and righteousness. He says, you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. Remember earlier in chapter 2, he was talking about children, and he said, you were children of wrath, you were sons of disobedience, in chapter 2, verse 2 and verse 3. And he's going to pick up on that a little bit here. It's the antithesis to that, the opposite, to walk as children of light. For the fruit of the Spirit, or the fruit of light, some translations have, some manuscripts even have that, light, is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. And that really defines what light is. Light is goodness. It is righteousness, being right in the sight of God. It is truth. Proving, and you keep on doing this throughout life. That is a part of walking as children of light. We keep on proving what is acceptable to the Lord. And don't we do that throughout life? We'll never reach a point that, you know, I've got it all down now. Don't have to worry about that anymore. We will have to continue to prove, to analyze what's going on in life and around us, that we can make the right choices, choose to walk in that path of righteousness. And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, again the opposite of that, but rather expose them, or to reprove them, or rebuke them. Okay. So that's taking a stand against sin. So we're not going to embrace it, we're not going to be in fellowship with it, but try to expose it. Sometimes the only way that we can expose it is to be the antithesis of it, okay? To live a life of righteousness, that there's going to be that contrast, okay? Like it's light walking out of a lighted room into a room of darkness, and all at once, whoa, I can really sense the difference there. So people need to sense that difference when they are around us. For it is shameful even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret. Now, often we do talk about those things that are done by them, right? So what is he saying here? It is shameful even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret.
Part of it could apply to the details going in. I mean, even in this class, I mean, last week when we were talking about some of the sins that the Gentiles were engaged in, we weren't very graphic about
yeah.
what we said.
That's it. Yeah. We can do that. We can cross that line, right?
And the Bible always speaks of things on a high plane, and we need to keep them there.
Yeah, right. Where we may cognitively know about those things, maybe not, you know, seen them per se, we probably got an idea what's going on, but it can be inappropriate to even discuss it. So we usually generalize, and I think that's good. We need to do that. Okay? You ever been in a class or in a lecture, and it's kind of, I'm not that comfortable with listening to this. Yeah, we have to be careful of that, be sensitive to that. Because it probably was among the Gentiles at that time, they were so acquainted with it, they were a part of that world at one time, it was just common to talk about those things. So he's changing the way that they think, even, which is going to even change their communication, and that's what he's been talking about, their communication. So he continues to talk about walking as children of light. But all things that are exposed are made manifest, visible by the light. Okay, we make those things visible by our communication, by the way that we live. In other words, it is saying to folks, and even in a nonverbal way, that's not right. Okay. And sometimes it is, and I've said this, and I know you have, I really don't want to hear that. Okay. You know, don't really want to be privy to that. And that's a part of making that manifest that isn't right. And whatever makes manifest is light. Light makes everything visible. And when we're walking in the light, that becomes who we are. People are going to sense the difference. That what they're doing in life is at least contrary to the way that we live. And cause them to stop and think about the life that they've chosen. Verse 14, therefore he says, and it's believed by some that this was an early baptismal hymn. When someone was baptized, they would sing this, awake, you who sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. So he begins by talking about spiritual death. Awake, you who sleep. And sometimes sleep is used in that way of describing spiritual death. You know, Paul uses that in 1 Corinthians. Arise from the dead, spiritually dead, and Christ will give you light. Okay. See then that you walk circumspectly or carefully, not as fools, but as wise. Wise people understand truth and they know how to live it out in life. Okay? They can make the proper assessments in life and live it out. Whereas the fool or the fools may have some understanding. In fact, they may have a lot of knowledge, but they don't know how to live out that knowledge in life. Have you seen people like that? Very intelligent, you know, to talk to them, but you kind of look at the life that they live and you kind of, don't get it. Where did that come from? And that would be, as the Bible would describe, a fool. Okay? So it can be very intelligent, but not much horse sense, if you will.
Like Romans 1, confess himself to be wise and became foolish, didn't
he? Yeah.
They were highly intelligent people,
mm-hmm.
and many of them probably very educated, but the immorality and the things that they were engaging in were foolish.
Yeah, very much so.
And they're casting God out of their mind, it was foolish what they were doing.
You think about some of the earlier philosophers, Socrates, Aristotle, others. You know, not that we would swallow everything that they said, but they were wise in some things that they said. But you look at their lives and they were very immoral themselves. Okay. In a lot of different ways. A lot of them were homosexuals and so forth. You know, it's unbelievable. But then some of our laws are based on some of the principles that they taught. Yes.
Same thing happens today, you know. Intellectuals many times are very loose morally,
mm-hmm.
and they really ought to know better, even without God. I mean, from creation, they ought to know certain things like homosexuality. It's not intended, it won't work, you know.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to have the Bible to know that, I mean, just from physical anatomy, you know.
That's it, yeah.
It's not going to work.
Right, and just look at the consequences, disease, social disease, all. It just kind of says, well, something's not right here, you know? The outcome just isn't healthy. Yeah. So he goes on and says, seeing that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time. This is a part of doing that, of walking carefully, as you redeem the time. That is to buy it for yourself and to use it appropriately. Use it for those godly, you know, purposes in life. Because the days are evil. Would you agree with that statement? Days are kind of filled with a lot of evil, right? Back then and even today. So we can't waste our time. Therefore, because we need to redeem the time and the days are evil, do not be unwise, but number one, understand what the will of the Lord is. Okay? Secondly, do not be drunk with wine in which is dissipation or riotous living. Now let me ask something right here. Why does he bring in this thought here? Don't be drunk with wine. And remember the context here. To walk carefully, redeeming the time, understanding what the will of the Lord is.
Encourage yourself to do that.
Isn't it though? Big time. You know, you see somebody drunk, I mean, it affects the front part of the brain where we do our reasoning and, you know, all that evaluation stuff. Yeah, it affects there. It impairs our thinking. So, if my ability to reason, to think, is impaired, I'm not going to really know what the will of the Lord is. I'm not going to come to that logical, reasonable conclusion. So don't be drunk with wine. And added to that, again, it's sinful, but I just want to look at probably what he has in mind. But all of you, literally, that's what he's talking about, all be filled to be influenced with the Spirit. Okay. Now, jump over just for a moment. We'll come back to it. In Colossians, where there is that parallel passage, he says in verse 16, if you're in Colossians 3, 16, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your heart to the Lord. So when he says, be filled with the Spirit, what's he talking about?
That means the Word?
Yeah, being filled with the Spirit's Word, Word of Christ, because the Spirit becomes the agent of communicating that, communicating it now through the written Word. Okay. So as we're filled with the Spirit, we're being filled with the Word of Christ.
Yes. The Spirit was just something that came on to you, like people Pentecostals talk about today. How could you command that?
Yeah.
How could you command somebody to be filled with the Spirit if it was just something that, you know, you had no control over that just came on to you?
Exactly.
So, with the parallel passage, obviously it has to be you imbibe more of the Spirit's Word.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's something we can do because, again, it's a part of this walking circumspectly, it's a part of redeeming the time. Therefore, this is something that has to happen so I can fulfill that wish.
We have to understand what the will of the Lord is. So it's not something that's just going to come on us miraculously.
And to understand that will, I have to be filled with the Spirit, the Word of Christ.
I appreciate this point, Mike, because I never noticed that. I mean, I've never made that connection before. I guess because we always quote verse 19 and don't think about it conjunctive with verse 18.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a good point.
Right. And then, when I am understanding what the will of the Lord is, and notice the conjunction, and let's just leave out the part of the impairment of drinking, and be filled with the Spirit, there's going to be an outcome to all of that, okay, which is the expression of being filled with the Spirit, beginning verse 19, using five participles. Now, a participle is like a verb used as an adjective to modify, to describe what's going to happen, okay? So he's describing this being filled with the Spirit, understanding what the Lord is, the will of the Lord is. Number one, we are going to be speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. See, often, as Mark was saying, we focus on then even verse 19 to do what? Yeah, to sing. And to prohibit what?
Instrumental music.
Yeah. That's kind of where we focus, right? We miss so much by doing it. I understand the validity of that, okay? Don't misunderstand me, because I believe all that, okay? But we miss so much if that's all that people are walking away with. Because when we are filled with the Spirit, filled with God's Word, it's influencing our lives. We have now the mind of Christ. We've conformed to that image. We are, number one, going to be speaking to one another. That is reciprocal. It's a reciprocal pronoun to one another. You'll be speaking to me. I'm going to be speaking to you in these pious songs and these hymns or these sacred songs and these spiritual odes to one another. Yes?
I think really needs to emphasize, because as much as we quote this verse, we're really missing the emphasis. I mean, yes, we're to sing and not play, but the emphasis is that we're filled with the Spirit, and this is an outpouring of that. And I'd have to say that there's many times when I think people that are coming and worshiping, they're, you know, I can't judge their heart, but it doesn't seem like they're very filled with the Spirit.
I know that.
This is an overflow of the Word of Christ dwelling in them richly.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I look at some people, it's like somebody's out there with a shotgun making them come into worship and do what they're doing, or they seem pretty upset.
Yeah, I know it.
And
it's more than, and here's a part of it, and I wish I had a lot of time to develop it. It's more than just hearing Christ's Word and reading it and understanding it. It is to change us. That it becomes a new attitude about us. We're excited because we've internalized that Word. It has changed us in our thinking and the way that we relate to one another and the way that we view God. It's just exciting, okay? And that's part of the zeal that we have now, okay? The enthusiasm, that's God dwelling in us. And I'm like you. You know, preachers have an opportunity to kind of, you know, invitation song to look out. And it's just like folks just standing there, literally, just like this. You know, is this thing about over with? I'm wondering, wait, something's missing here, okay? Because if they are filled with the Spirit, there's no containing that. It's almost like Jeremiah saying, you know, I'm going to stop that preaching stuff. But there was something in his bones, if you will. There was that enthusiasm within him that said, I just can't do this. I got to, you know, live out his relationship with God. Okay. So the first participle, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. And again, remember I said that is a reciprocal action, and that's why it's congregational singing. But that wasn't Paul's argument again, okay? It's secondary. Number two is singing, okay? We will be speaking and we will be singing, okay? And if you'll notice and you have time, you read through the Old Testament. They're singing, aren't they? The Psalms, often songs. Singing praises to God. Number three, making melody. Now, that's where we get the solo, and there's the solo argument. I don't have time to develop that. You've heard it, the plucking, the twanging. Early on, probably met an instrument, mechanical, in the development of the Word and time. It reached a point in Paul's writing. It met this vocal singing. That the instrument now, and he even points out the instrument that's used, is making melody, solo, in the heart to the Lord. So it's plucking the strings of the heart. That's what we've been talking about. And again, with what Mark said earlier, they're not plucking the strings, okay? It's not touching their heart anymore. Okay? Put their instrument down, if you will. And then, verse 20 is giving thanks. Okay? Now, if I'm filled with the Spirit, excited about what God has done for me, I'm going to give thanks. It's going to be giving thanks always and for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. That can be difficult at times, can it? But notice what he's doing here. If I have this changed mind as a result of this relationship with God, I'm not in this alone. Even in those difficult times, I can still give thanks. It's when I don't have the mind of Christ, that new mind, that it continues to be a struggle. Because it's like it's me against the world. But in the context here, no, it's not me against the world. My brothers and sisters are there for me. It's in a relationship with God. Because as he says, it's in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. And number 5, in verse 21, is then submitting to one another in the fear of the Lord. Okay? Submitting to rank under. Now, let me say this about submitting. I don't think that he's talking here about reciprocal submitting. Just everybody submit to one another. Okay? As often it's looked at. Usually when folks look at this, they'll say, okay, it's submitting one to another. You submit to me, I submit to you. Husbands submit to wives, wives submit to husbands. We've got everybody submitting to everybody else. I don't think what he's talking about. He makes that statement, then he goes on to qualify what he's talking about. Okay? And what he's going to be talking about, and I'll list them for you, and then we'll go through them. Number 1 in verse 20, wives, submit to your own husbands. Okay? Number 2, 20, verse 24, church, submit to Christ. Now, if it is reciprocal, like everyone often, I say everyone, like a lot of folks talk about, then Christ has to submit to the church. Then fit. No. So he gives up his headship, he comes down here, and we start telling Christ what to do, okay? You don't like that, we're going to change that. You can't say anything about it because you're submit to us. No, it doesn't mean that. And we'll look more at that in a moment. Number 3 is in chapter 6, verse 1. Children, obey or submit to your parents. Then in verse 5, servants, submit or be obedient to your masters. Okay.
Mentioned this before, but yeah. Peter kind of does the same thing in 1 Peter 5, only his is, instead of an introductory statement, is a concluding statement. You know, he talks about citizens to the government in chapter 2, he talks about the servants to masters in chapter 2, and wives to husbands in chapter 3, and then the members to the elders, and finally caps it off in chapter 5. So, and in 1 Peter 5, he says, submit one to another.
Yeah.
Subject one to another. I think it's the same idea. It's not mutual submission, but rather in these ways.
Yeah, exactly.
That I'm about to detail, or in Peter's case, as I've already detailed in the epistle.
That's exactly it. And that's what he's doing here. And he goes on to detail that. Verse 25, or back in verse 22, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, as you would submit to Christ. So you're to submit to your own husbands. You know how difficult that is for, let me say, my clients to accept? You know, if I'm dealing with, you know, a couple and they're having problems and we deal with anything like, why submit? I'm not going to do that. Okay. And I think sometimes the problem is husbands aren't the kind of husbands they need to be. And that being, it's almost like they're going to be the dictator. I wouldn't want to submit to that person either. Now, what makes this work is when it gets down in verse 25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church. When that takes place in a home, then the submission takes place in the home. There is respect and care for one another. Okay. The point is, wives submit because husbands sacrifice, even as Christ also gave himself for the church. He didn't submit, he sacrificed. So, wives submit and their husbands will sacrifice for the wife. And that makes a big difference, right? Because if I'm not willing to sacrifice, it's my way, because I'm the head of the house here. You're going to have a lot of problems. Okay? The marriage hasn't been cultivated properly. Okay, so let's walk through this. So he talks about, verse 23, the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Okay, and being the Savior, he had to die for the church, right? Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Everything that would be right in the will of God, not just a blanket statement and everything. No, the comparison is, or the example is, Jesus and the church and the relationship that exists there. Then in verse 25, husbands love, and it comes from agape, which is a sacrificial love, right? It makes those sacrifices. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. So there's the example. As Christ was willing to sacrifice, so husbands need to be willing to sacrifice, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. And that goes back to, you know, the baptism of the individual Christians, and collectively they make up the church, and the process was to sanctify and to cleanse, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. Okay? How do we treat our bodies? And if we're in our right mind, we're not beating up ourselves. We're not taking advantage of ourselves. We're not hurting ourselves. We're not depriving ourselves of those things that are needed, right? We're pretty good to ourselves. He who loves his wife loves himself. Okay? And there's a lot in that, okay? I am a firm believer that we need to love ourselves. Because if we don't love ourselves, we're going to really struggle in loving other people. And that's usually why folks really struggle with forming and maintaining healthy relationships, because they don't really have a good love for themselves. I probably shared this with you. I'll do it again. Remember the acrostic joy? What's this?
Jesus.
Okay. What's wrong with this?
That's a funny question, right?
Pardon? You're putting yourself last.
There you go. Let me tell you how it should go. And then we can't use it like we used to. This goes up here. Why? Yourself. Okay? Love God with all that you are, heart, soul, strength, and mind. And your neighbor
as yourself.
As yourself. Not above yourself, as yourself. I think, let me say this, I think when we pull this down here, and we've done that for years, it means I can't consider myself. You know, I just put everybody else first. And before long, we get lost in the equation. We don't have the proper love for ourselves because we think if we love ourselves, we're prideful and something's wrong. We're self-centered, you know, we're egotistic and all like that. And by doing that, then we struggle with this because my love for others comes from how I love myself. If I don't really love myself, I probably won't think a whole lot of you either, because that even makes me feel worse. Does that make sense?
I think maybe in an effort, you know, extreme against extreme.
Yeah.
And since most people put themselves up on the throne, we kind of swing as much as we can to.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I don't question the motive in all of this, okay? But then I look at it and say, but there's probably a better way of doing this and describing it. Certainly put Christ first. Then we're there. So, love your wife as you love yourself. Verse 29, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church. Now the word nourish means to promote health, to strengthen, to make strong. And to cherish is a very beautiful word which has to do with to keep warm, like to embrace. Okay. Don't we do that to ourselves? Yeah, we pretty well, we take care of ourselves. We love ourselves. That's how the Lord relates to the church. He promotes health. He keeps it warm, if you will, like his arms wrapped around it. Verse 30, the reason for all of this is we are members of his body, of his flesh, of his bones. That's why he cares for us so dearly. Why? He nourishes us and cherishes us as his body. Now, this idea of his flesh and his bones, where did that thought come from? When Adam looked at Eve, what did he say? Flesh of my flesh. Yeah. Okay. So he was going to cherish her, to nourish her. Now, he's using this in relationship to the Christ in the church, but he will transition for a moment to look at the husband-wife relationship. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. We understand that on the physical level, right? But he's going to go on to say, this is a great mystery. I speak concerning Christ and the church. Okay, what is this idea of leaving and cleaving? What are they doing, the man and the woman? What are they leaving?
The old life they
had. Leaving what else would be a part of that old life? Old boyfriends and girlfriends, right? Okay. Leaving all of that to cleave, to be glued to, joined to this one, so we can become one flesh. Oh, this is a great mystery, but I'm really talking about Christ and the church. As a church, what are we leaving and what are we cleaving?
Sinful life.
Sinful life. Yeah. For a lot of them, the idol. The old girlfriends, if you will, okay? Leaving that to cling to cleave to Christ, right?
I was kind of thinking of more along the lines of, it says you'll leave your father and mother. Jesus said they were of the father of the devil. You know, you're taken from the devil's family and put into God's family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you cleave together, you created a new household.
Yeah.
You're no longer part of your parents' household.
Mm-hmm.
Is the mystery here, is that referring to them becoming one flesh, or is that referring to Christ and the church?
From what I've read, it's almost like it doesn't relate to anything other than I'm just giving you the insight into what I'm talking about. What I would see, if I'm using this as a great mystery, what he's talking about is, I'm really talking about the church. You're thinking more on a physical level as he would be addressing his readers, but I'm really talking about on a spiritual level. Your relationship with Christ. Does that make sense?
So, I mean, using mystery in the sense, a similar sense to what he used in chapter 3, is something that the idea that it had not been revealed until this point, our relationship with Christ and the church in the sense of husband and wife? Or?
Well, I'm thinking he's using the sense of you just haven't gotten it yet. Okay, to you, for them, it was a mystery. Not in the sense that no one could have known anything about it, because they could have. Because other places would talk about the spiritual relationship where we're a spouse or married to Christ. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, I think, or something. So it earlier talked about. I think in this sense he's using it as, you haven't got it yet, so I'm just going to make that known to you in a clearer way. Yeah.
He said, this is a great mystery.
Right.
That which is revealed, not revealed. What's that? Well, that marriage was a preview of Christ's relation to the church.
Mm-hmm.
It's now being revealed. That was a preview, I don't know if it'd be an antitype, of Christ's relation to the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are so many parallels there. Yeah, exactly. Right. So
I've had discussions with people as far as the one flesh, and the people have not understood. You know, I mean, there's different ways in which that's used, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard people teach this both ways, that it's referring to the marriage. This is a great mystery. And I kind of lean more towards the church, because I don't see any great marriage truth that's being.
No, I would lean more toward the church.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just wondering how we would tell that more.
Well, I guess where I'm coming from is I don't think it was a mystery in the sense of this is the first time you have heard anything about this. Okay. Because we could read earlier epistles and see he's been talking about the same thing. So I think a part of that they could have figured out themselves. But I think where it is their minds clouded, darkened by what was being taught around them, all like that. I think the point is, it's a mystery for you right now because you're just not getting it. But I want you to understand the relationship that Christ has with the church, and how that parallels to a marriage relationship. Therefore, you can't go back to that old sinful life and try to maintain a spiritual relationship with Christ, just as husbands and wives can't do that and maintain a healthy relationship with one another.
Yeah. But the details in chapter 3 that were talked about as being mystery, they're talked about in other epistles as well.
Mm.
The point there is that it wasn't revealed until it was the first century. Do you see what I'm saying?
Okay, I see that where you're coming from.
So just because, you know, Colossians might have talked about this relationship too, and that details might have been in that he had written before,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't until the first century that the mystery was revealed in that sense.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. The only thing, even the Old Testament, God is looked at as a husband many times, and Israel as his bride,
mm-hmm.
and she had become unfaithful. Yeah. Could be, yeah. Then in verse 33, nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respect her own husband. Okay. Which kind of takes us back to where he began in verse 22. Okay. Make that circle. Any questions on chapter 5? Okay, going into chapter 6, he talks about the children. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, as ordained by God, according to His instructions. For this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. Okay, we'll look at that in just a second. Here's the promise. That it may be well with you, and you may live long on the earth. Is that a guarantee? That's kind of like a proverb, isn't it?
General principle.
Yeah, general principle. Now, he says something here, that this is the first commandment with promise. But if you'll jump back just for a moment to Exodus, this comes from the Decalogue, Ten Commandments. Notice verse, let's just pick up verse 4 just for a second. You shall not make for yourself any carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting iniquity on the fathers, on the children, the third and fourth generations, to those who hate me, but, what? Showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. Is that not a commandment with a promise? And that proceeds. Verse 12. Honor your father and mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. So he can't mean this is the first commandment that was ever given that has a promise. Because we already read about one that happened just before then. Well, what he may be meaning is first can be like position, or first in a meaningful way in a person's life. Okay, like for children, this would be a very prominent, important commandment because of the promise related to it. Okay. That if you will obey your parents, and these are loving, caring parents, they're going to keep you out of a lot of problems, out of a lot of trouble. Okay. So for the child, it is a very important commandment. But also, it may be this. Remember, Jesus talked about the first commandment is to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. The second commandment, like that, which may be dividing the Ten Commandments into the top, what is it, four, and then the bottom six that relate to man's relationship with man. This would be the first of those commandments that would be talking about human relationships and children in that human relationship. Obey your parents, because this is the first commandment given to human beings as it would relate human to human with a promise. Okay. Does that make sense? If not,
could it have a reference chronologically to somebody in their life? The first thing you understand is you obey these parents because that's gonna help you out in life, and you understand that before you understand really a lot about obeying God.
Mm-hmm.
You understand respect for authority of your parents.
It could, but I'm not really sure. Yeah. I myself would lean more toward first being a position of importance. In other words, this is important to you. I want y'all to get this. Because if they don't follow their parents, they're going to follow somebody, okay? Usually their peers, whom they think are very wise and who are very foolish at times.
Do you say that, I mean, so is that more prominent than not making graven images?
For a child, it would be. That's what I'm saying. In the context for a child, this is important. For me right now, it doesn't mean a whole lot because my parents are dead. But for a child growing up, very important. Because they're going to know very little, probably, about obeying God. But they need to know a whole lot, like you're saying, about obeying parents. Because in that developmental time, it's going to save you a lot of problems, maybe even getting killed. You know, my friends are wanting to go out. We're going to go joyride. We're not going to do anything wrong. Yeah, right. You're not going to go. Okay. By not going can save a lot of lives, right? Yeah. So that's kind of how I believe on that. In verse 4, and you fathers, do not provoke. The idea is to so irritate the child, to provoke them to wrath. Don't do that. Do fathers sometimes do that? I know a lot of fathers that do that, okay? I just have another sector of society I have to deal with. A lot of times they are provoking their children to wrath, and then the children are getting blamed for it when they're provoked to that point, okay? But here's what you are to do, to bring them up. Now notice the word bring them up. Does anybody have a different translation?
Standard.
What is this thing?
It says, you fathers provoke back here, but nurture them in the chastening and admonition.
There you go. That's that word. That's the same word back in verse 29 of the previous chapter. Nourish. Nourish. Okay? But nourish them. Bring them up. And here's how to do that. In the training and admonition of the Lord. The training has to do with teaching. To discipline. Okay, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And to admonish, which means instruction with warning. And don't we do that as parents? You know, we warn, we instruct. Don't do that. It's dangerous. And it's like, you know, when Johnny wants to go joyriding, I don't think it's enough just to say no. I think a part of this is we tell them why. So they are informed. Because what are we trying to do? To help them to develop to the point that they're making good choices themselves, because we can't always be there. But what we share with them can always be there. Okay, the voice can be within the head. Now, the word discipline. What comes to mind when you hear the word discipline? Punishment. That's often what we think. But there's a big difference. When we properly look at discipline, what are we talking about? To teach. To instruct. To guide. To help one to develop. You know, a lot of times in education, we talk about studying a certain discipline. We're not talking about studying a certain punishment, because I don't like that, right? We are called disciples. Because the Lord punishes us? No. Because He loves us. Because a part of discipline is love. Instruct. And the envelope, if you will, is this idea of to nurture, to care for. To do that, we need instruction. We need discipline, guidance. Now, there may be at times we do need some punishment because we have dismissed all of this. And to get one's attention, to get one back under discipline, which is good, healthy, enjoyable, there has to be some of that.
That's Hebrews chapter 12, isn't it?
The chastening of the Lord. Okay.
To bring it back into that.
Okay. But that's the focus. So these fathers are to stop provoking their children to wrath, but they are to nurture them in the training, the teaching, the discipline, and to warn them, the warning of the Lord. Okay. Give me just a second. Very familiar passage. 2 Timothy 3:16. All scripture is given by the inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction.
Same word.
Training, the discipline. Instruction in righteousness. Not to whip us into that position, but to train us that we embrace that. Then, with this discipline teaching, we often talk about self. Discipline, right? Well, ultimately, that's what we're developing in our children, that we teach them so they learn, they are instructed in this environment of love, that they understand this unconditional love that we have for them, because someday they're going to have to do this on their own with self-teaching, discipline, and warning, right? And if I am irritating, provoking my child, they're not going to get there. We're going to have to deal with a lot of rebellion in that context. Any questions up to this point? Okay. We're out of time. Next time we'll finish up with this The ones that are taking the class for credit, do you all have email? Let's see, you
yeah.
Two, you have email.
Yeah.
Who else is?
Cecil's
not here, is he? Okay. He probably has email, I think. More than likely what I'm thinking about is the last exam.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just let you email me the answers to that and so forth.
I don't think Cecil has email.
Oh, he doesn't.
He said his wife does, but he doesn't.
Okay.